Level 5 lockdown until the first week in March. That's the lead headline in the Irish Independent, which in common with the Irish Examiner and Irish Daily Mirror, leads this morning with plans agreed by the Cabinet Committee on COVID-19 yesterday to extend the current lockdown. Decisions made at that same meeting related to travel restrictions generate the lead stories in the Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail. Both papers report that mandatory quarantine in designated hotels for incoming travellers without a negative test, increased fines for non-compliance with rules, and a ban on travel from South Africa and Brazil are likely to be approved by the Cabinet this morning. It's also reported that travellers without a negative test will face a fine of up to €2,500 and or up to 6 months imprisonment, and returning holidaymakers are also likely to face increased fines. Under the headline, Cracking Down on Travel Finally, the Mail reports that the government made the decision to step up measures, as it is feared that there is potential that new variants of the virus may render vaccines less effective. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Sun reports that those aged over 85 are the next group to be vaccinated. Back on the front of the Examiner, it's reported that the mobile phone operator Three is providing the Department of Health and the CSO with data on its 2.4 million Irish customers to monitor compliance levels. The Irish News leads with the line that Northern Ireland Health Minister Robin Swan is also pushing for enforced quarantine for people travelling to Northern Ireland from abroad. The Irish Daily Star leads with a 3-year jail sentence given to a man with 45 previous offences, including 6 for knife-related offences in Dublin Circuit Criminal Court yesterday. Mark Pidgeon from Coolock in Dublin received the sentence for repeatedly stabbing a man in the Basin Street flats in Dublin 8 last March. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports that the PSNI has launched an investigation after a large crowd appeared to break coronavirus regulations while attending the funeral in Derry yesterday of 62-year-old former Republican prisoner Eamon Peggy McCourt. The Times and Examiner both give front-page coverage to a new report about drug-related intimidation in Dublin's northeast inner city. The report, called Deaths, Threats, Distress and Hope, concludes that there is a sense of once strong and close-knit community breaking down. Another report on the cost of building an apartment in Dublin, compiled by the Society of Chartered Surveyors of Ireland, also receives coverage on the front of today's Independent and Times. The Times focuses on how the cost of building a two-bedroom apartment in Dublin ranges from €359,000 in the suburbs to as much as €619,000 in the city centre. And finally, the picture on the front of today's Independent is of Ireland's latest Michelin star winner, Amit Dede, who we're told adds his Turkish flair to the best local produce, which he sources for his restaurant in Baltimore in West Cork, which was named in yesterday's virtual awards ceremony.
Tánaiste Thelly of Oiradhcur has said the lockdown will be extended to the 5th of March. Speaking on Clareburn Live, he said there would be a series of new travel restrictions discussed at Cabinet this morning.
The advice to Cabinet is that we should extend the lockdown, level 5 lockdown as it is, until the 5th of March. That's to align us with Northern Ireland, which we think is important. But also it does allow for the phased reopening of education. There will be a travel ban from those countries listed as being of concern by the ECDC, so that's Brazil and South Africa. For anyone who does come in from those countries somehow, or anyone who doesn't have a negative test, they will be required to stay in a hotel. It'll be mandatory hotel quarantine for them. It means getting a quarantine centre set up. This is going to take a few weeks to operationalise, I have to be honest about that. It's really important that people don't see the issue of international travel controls as a silver bullet. About 40,000 people, unfortunately, have contracted COVID in the last 2 weeks. Very few of them got it because of international travel.
Now, in response to these new and proposed measures, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties' Liam Herrick told our reporter Fiacra Kiona last night a number of practical issues have to be addressed before we introduce mandatory quarantining.
What's essential here is that the state will now be taking on a duty of care for these people who are deprived of their liberty while they're in quarantine. So it's essential that everybody is assessed for health and mental health before they're quarantined. It's essential that the centres are properly staffed with suitably trained staff, that there is healthcare provision of an adequate level, that the conditions and food meet the needs of those that are detained, and that also people have access to a lawyer, to a complaint system, and that there's effective inspection of these places. Now, this has been done in many other jurisdictions. We've had a long time to learn from these other countries. So I think if the government wants to introduce a proper, effective system that meets human rights standards, these are the key standards it will have to meet.
Liam Herrick of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. The Irish Times political editor Pat Leahy can take us through some of the detail now of these proposals, which are expected to be agreed by Cabinet later today. Good morning, Pat.
Morning,
now,
Mary.
The level five restrictions that we live under right now and that were under review, they're going to go on until the 5th of March in line with Northern Ireland. Talk us through, though, these tough new additional measures that are under proposal.
I suppose there's two broad areas. One is tightening the enforcement of existing restrictions, and the second is the introduction of the new quarantine requirement that we just heard about there. So there would be a mandatory quarantine in designated hotels for travellers that are coming in without a negative PCR test for the virus. Now, those travellers are not supposed to be coming already, and if they do, they may also face a fine of £2,500 or up to €2,500 or up to 6 months imprisonment. But they will be legally required to isolate or to quarantine in a hotel facility. But there will also be a legal requirement for all passengers who come into the country to restrict their movements for 14 days on arrival. And we're told that there will be much more stringent checking of that by Gardaí. That includes people who have a negative test for virus. Currently, that is only guidance, but it will be upgraded to have the force of law, and there will be penalties. There will be penalties for it. Other than that, we're looking at much stricter, as I say, enforcement of current restrictions. Ministers last night were saying particularly that there will be checkpoints, far more checkpoints set up by Gardaí at and near the airport, so that people who are returning from holidays abroad or people who are returning for abroad for reasons other than essential travel will face stiffer fines. There'll also be checkpoints set up within 5 kilometres of the border to ensure that the 5 kilometre limit currently on travel from your home, apart from essential reasons, is being observed.
Pat, there's some noise on our line. I'm not sure if it's a cable or what it is between us, but we'll press on. The limited but mandatory hotel quarantine, have we any clear details yet on how the government envisages this working? Because Liam Herrick is setting out very clearly there the issues that have to be under consideration.
Yeah, I heard his contribution earlier. Now, that certainly wasn't the sort of thing that people were talking about last night. Bear in mind that these proposals were agreed at a cabinet subcommittee last night. They'll be put to the full cabinet for further discussion, and I expect approval today. There'll be a memo for cabinet drawn up overnight to give effect to those. So we should have a better idea of how it's going to work in practice later, and I expect that there will be a press conference by Taoiseach, Mr. Bradker, possibly the Green leader, Eamon Ryan.
Or even Taoiseach Micheál Martin.
It's the mistake everybody is making.
They do indeed, Pat.
That's likely to take place sometime in the afternoon after cabinet. So those sort of details are likely to be fleshed out between now and then. But for now, the decision has been made in principle by ministers, and the application of it. And Mr. Varadkar said this last night in his Clare Byrne interview, that the application of this is going to take some time to figure out, not least because new legislation will be required to implement certain aspects of the decisions taken yesterday.
So how long will it actually take before they're implemented?
That depends on the individual measures. So legislation are legal regulations to be made by ministers. That takes obviously some time to go through the Dáil in the case of legislation. The Dáil is currently operating on very restricted capacity. So what I think you'll see, that where legislation is needed, it'll be rushed through the Dáil as soon as possible. Obviously, operational changes like stiffer Garda enforcement, that can take place almost immediately. But the arrangements for hotels and that is obviously going to take some time.
Take,
I imagine
just quick.
Yes, a matter sorry, of weeks before yeah. that can be set up.
And on education, addressed by Leo Varadkar as well last night, their hope or plan is still additional needs education, followed by primary, I think, and exam classes.
I understand very little discussion of this at the meeting yesterday, more likely to be discussion on this later in the week. As of now, the meeting made the decision to recommend to Cabinet that the current lockdown is extended until March the 5th. So there is hope in government that we will see some phased return to education before that date.
All right, Pat Leahy of the Irish Times, thank you. 20 minutes past seven.
Let's talk now to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. Fergal, in terms of the numbers and where they need to be by March the 5th, if there's to be any change in these restrictions, can NPHET predict where they will or may be at that point?
Well, NPHET, I think, would always be cautious about giving a long-term prediction. But we did hear from them last night that the case numbers in the community, they were growing at 18% a day in the run-up to January. They're now decreasing by 8 to 10% a day. So that is encouraging. The incidence of this virus is falling, but it does remain high. So we appear to be on the right path in terms of suppressing the virus. It is hard to say exactly, though, where we will be by, say, the 5th of March, but in a better place, hopefully. And of course, you know, the new variants have an impact there. We know the UK variant is here. There's no evidence yet, we are told, that the Brazilian variant is here. Although, you know, I think our ability to sequence and detect new variants may be an issue there, because the UK variant was detected in Britain in September. We detected it here officially on Christmas Eve. So, you know, the searching for it and detecting it is also an issue.
And of course, the level of cases in the community may continue to fall, hopefully, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the pressures on our hospitals will change significantly by March the 5th, because people who are sick from this virus tend to be sicker for longer.
That's true. I mean, the latest figures overnight from the HSE show 1,803 patients with COVID-19 in hospital, and of those, 217 in ICU. They are decreasing numbers. And NPHET says the number of people in hospital, including ICU, has peaked and has plateaued. That is important, but that it's going to take many weeks to get the numbers down. And the numbers of admissions to hospital have decreased below 100 over the past 7 days. Here's Professor Philip Nolan, who chairs the modelling group of NPHET, explaining about that reduction in cases in hospitals.
We're seeing continued rapid improvement in the incidence of the disease. We're seeing, as expected, numbers in hospital plateauing, and expect them to decline very slowly over the coming weeks. And the fundamental message is that we're not going to need to maintain the efforts that have got us to this position for several weeks to come. So over the last 7 days or 5 days, depending on how you look at it, we've seen around 2,000 cases per day on average. So very much less than we were seeing a few weeks ago, but just to remind you, very, very high indeed.
Professor Philip Nolan there. Fergal, in terms of vaccination, real question marks now over the supply and production of AstraZeneca's vaccine, which has yet to be approved by the European Medical Agency. Nonetheless, Stephen Donnelly is saying, the Minister for Health is saying, that the vaccination programme for the over 85s will begin. They're next in line. Do we know when that will start?
Well, he says community vaccination there, that's due to begin in mid-February. It'll be subject to regulatory approval of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which I think people are hoping to see on Friday. And we do need to see whether it gets the full green light. You know, for example, will it be approved for everyone over 65 years of age? Some question marks about that coming out of Germany last night. But the plan here is to start with, GPs would be doing this vaccination, start with those aged 85 years and over, then followed by those aged 80 to 84, 75 to 79, and people aged 70 to 74. Ireland, we're told by the Minister, will receive a vaccine delivery of the AstraZeneca vaccine within the lower range of what was expected for February. And also, delivery in March is likely to be considerably lower than what was originally stated by the company. So, I mean, that is a problem. We're told 140,000 vaccinations have been done to date, but there's still no sign of a promised published daily vaccination data. And we're into coming to the end of January now.
Yeah, and we know that not all residents in nursing homes, not all frontline workers have got their first jab of any vaccine yet. So is the schedule falling behind?
Well, in the absence of detailed data on vaccination, you know, where we are, who's got it, what regions, how much has been done, how far we are behind, we can't get a picture of that until this data is officially published on the government website. But the HSE has said that due to the outbreaks of COVID-19, four long-term care facilities were not included in the first getting vaccinations. That was on public health advice. So with around 120 homes not completely done due to active outbreaks, but we're told they will be revisited, but I don't see a timeline yet on that. Last week, some second doses were administered in long-term care facilities, and we're told by the HSE that second doses will be administered in 27 nursing homes this week. But there are many, many more homes than that, of course, to be vaccinated.
Okay, Fergal, thank you very much. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers, 7:26.
An independent group that researched the running of mother and baby homes in Northern Ireland will present its findings to the Stormont executive later today. More than 10,000 women passed through the doors of 10 homes and 4 Magdalen laundries they examined, and many are demanding a public inquiry. One of them, who wishes to be known only as Adele, spent 7 months in the Marion Vale home run by the Good Shepherd Sisters in Newry in County Down. She spoke to our Northern correspondent, Vincent Kearney.
I became pregnant when I was 17 to a very short-term relationship. And when my parents found out, I was duly escorted by the parish priest and my mother to Marion Vale. I spent the next 7 months in Marion Vale and stayed there until after my son was born and adopted. It was quite soul-destroying. I left the home the same day as my son left, and I went back to my family, and their life went on without any further conversation about the child, anything that happened or happened to me. I never really spoke about that until 40 years later when my son came to look for me, which was the most joyous day of my life, that he actually came to find me. From then on, I felt I had no more secrets to hide, because I lived a life, most of my adult life, burying secrets and telling lies.
Did you want to go into the home? Had you any choice? Why did your family take you there?
Yeah, I had absolutely no choice. It was impressed upon me that there was no choice, that I couldn't keep the baby, that the baby had to be adopted, and there was no way he was coming home. When I got there, that was further impressed upon me by the nuns. They first thing they did was they removed my name. They took my name from me and gave me another name, completely different. We weren't allowed to speak of where we came from, our backgrounds, but of course we did. We spoke at night in the dormitories. We whispered when there was no nuns about and nobody spying upon us.
What was the attitude of the nuns towards you and the other young girls who were there?
Some of them were fine, but some of them most certainly were not. They were forever making snide remarks, cruel remarks, that we were fallen women, that we were bad girls, that we had to pay for our sins. And one of my lasting memories is putting on a show for them. We had to dance and sing and perform, like performing monkeys, for their entertainment. And meanwhile, listening to their snide remarks, it was very difficult. And that's left me with a memory I'll never forget.
Did you feel back then, I mean, how did you feel? Was it a sense that you were isolated? Did you feel lonely? Were you fearful?
Completely. All those words. I was afraid. I was worried. I was... would my family take me home? That also was an issue. But some of the girls, their families didn't take them home or didn't want to take them home. And they went on then maybe to work in the laundries or to work in other areas that really I didn't know anything much about. But my family did take me home. But it was with stipulations that it never would be spoke again, that my son would never be mentioned again, that what happened in Marionvale was never mentioned or discussed.
How did that feel, not being able to speak about a child you just had?
Horrendous. Horrendous. If you internalise things like that, it's bound to manifest itself in some way. And all through my life, my adult life, I feel I have suffered from anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder now, which is now recognised. It wasn't really then. I had no counselling, I had no address, nobody to talk to about it.
And this report is going to be presented to the executive, yes, for the executive to then decide what will happen next. What should happen next?
I and many others feel that it should be a public inquiry, but it has to be open and transparent. It also has to be victim and survivor led. The organisations who were involved in this need to be called to account. The executive really needs to step up and address these very, very difficult issues. And from my point of view, we need to shine the bright light of truth and justice upon these dark corners and upon our history. It is history, and we need to address it.
And that was Adele talking about her experience in the Marionvale Mother and Baby Home in Newry in County Down. She was talking to Vincent Kearney. It's 7:30.
The supermarket chain Lidl is to create 1,200 new jobs in Ireland over the next year. The company intends to open 4 new outlets and rebuild a number of its existing stores. Separately, 140 new roles are to be created in Dublin by the German HR technology developer Personio. Convenience food group Greencore reported revenue of £312 million in its first quarter, a decrease of 15% on the previous year. This reflects the impact of COVID-19 restrictions on demand in food-to-go categories. In a trading update this morning, Greencore said the operational impact of Brexit has been modest to date, as the group had completed extensive Brexit planning. Janet Yellen has been confirmed as the first ever female US Treasury Secretary. She'll be responsible for guiding the Biden administration's economic response to the pandemic. Let's take a look at the currencies. €1 buys 89 pence sterling and $1.21.3.
Sports news now with Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Mary. Well, the Irish men's cricket team are looking to finish their Afghanistan series on a high. They lost the first two matches and so the series, but they've started really well in this third game. They won the toss, elected to bowl. The Afghans 54 for 3 after 7 overs. The Irish took 2 wickets in 3 balls, so they've started really well here. Play began at 7 a.m. Bit of a delay there. Issues on the motorway. Both teams delayed getting to the venue. And qualification for the 2023 World Cup is through a league format this time around. So this isn't completely a dead rubber. There's valuable points on offer here this morning. Tottenham beat Championship strugglers Wickham 4-1 to reach the FA Cup fifth round. Wickham took the lead. Gareth Bale equalised. But then late goals by Winks and 2 from the inform in Ndombele sealed the victory. Those 3 goals came in the last 5 minutes, so the win not as comfortable as it would seem. Here's their manager, Jose Mourinho.
Of course, dominating, of course, having the chances. Of course, the feeling of we are closer to win than to lose. But game open until minute 85, so was not a Wickham that killed a giant, but was a Wickham that gave a big, big fight.
Spurs away to Everton in the next round. Thomas Tuchel expected to be named as the new Chelsea manager before their next game against Wolves tomorrow. Now the club hope that he'll be able to attend the game. Stuart Lancaster of the Leinster coaching team feels Tadhg Furlong is likely to start in their side's Guinness Pro 14 game against Scarlets this weekend. The prop has been sidelined for almost 12 months. Furlong has been named in the Irish squad for the upcoming Six Nations. Lancaster also confirmed that Johnny Sexton's muscle injury is not as bad as first thought. The Irish skipper suffered the knock against Munster last weekend.
Yeah, I think so. I think pretty optimistic, really. I think it was a minor thing, really, and yeah, I've not seen him, to be honest, but certainly speaking to him after the game, he was pretty optimistic, and I think all the news since then has been pretty optimistic too.
Paul Murphy's been announced as the Kerry football captain for 2021. Eddie Brennan has spoken for the first time about his departure as manager of the Laois Hurlers. Speaking on 2FM's Game On last night, Brennan denied there was any fallout over some critical remarks about the Laois County Board, which were made public on a GAA podcast. He said the reason for moving on came down to the financing of the team.
No, they didn't, because standalone thing, it happened and we moved on from that. The game changer really centred around going forward, you know, for the Laois of this world to make the step up. You need to be, you know, resourced. And again, you're looking at when you're going forward into from year one, two and three, obviously the level of support has to increase a little bit, you know, and there was a huge reduction in resources that was available to us. And that was the simple reason. And we had a vision of where we saw it going, and it was just at odds with it wasn't shared by the county board. And obviously, look, a lot of county boards are struggling in the absence of club matches, which is their main source of income. So, look, it is what it is and you move on. But look, such is life. You learn from something and you move on.
Yeah, such is life indeed. Finally, a little bit of breaking news has just been confirmed that today's horse racing at Down Royal has been cancelled. Parts of the track, they're frozen, so unfit for action. Back to you, Audrey.
Supplies of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine to this country will be considerably lower in March than expected. They will be at the lower end of the expected supply for February as well. That's according to the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly. The vaccine has yet to be approved by the European Medicines Agency. Ireland's order is for 3.3 million doses. The European Health Commissioner told reporters last night in Brussels that the EU wants to know exactly which doses have been produced by AstraZeneca and to whom they have been delivered. Stella Kyriakides said the company's explanation so far had not been satisfactory. Meanwhile, supply problems and viral outbreaks means delays for people here who were meant to get the vaccine. Stephen Donnelly said the over 85s are next in line, but no firm start date for that is known at the moment. But with so many essential workers looking to get vaccinated and moved up the queue, how is it decided who gets the jab first? Well, the woman who was part of that decision-making process is on the line now. Dr. Siobhan O'Sullivan is Chief Bioethics Officer with the Department of Health and is a member of NEPHET. Good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
Dr. O'Sullivan, is it always those who are most at risk of getting the virus and dying from it who will get the vaccine first?
Yes, so part of the strategy, the allocation strategy, it's important to say that it's anticipated that obviously we will roll out this programme over time and that everybody for whom the vaccine is indicated will get it. But initially, as you've pointed out, there are limited vaccines available. So it's going to take some time for everybody to receive those vaccines. So there has to be decisions made about how we can allocate this very scarce resource in the first instance. And so the way that that was done was that the National Immunisation Advisory Committee, along with ourselves and the Department of Health, so NIAC are our expert body who give us recommendations in respect of who are those who are at most risk. So effectively, the starting point here was to look at those who are most at risk of dying or maybe developing severe disease if they catch the virus. And so we know that, for example, increasing age is one of the clearest risk factors associated with dying or becoming very ill. So that's why we've prioritised that group. But I suppose in conjunction with looking at all of that kind of epidemiological data, some of the clinical data, it's also important to recognise, and we do recognise that, that many people feel very anxious, have been really impacted in very, very significant ways And are very eager to have the vaccine.
Yes, so because I'm just wondering, is it too blunt of an instrument? Because you then, once you have set out the parameters, you get into then the ethical dilemmas, because many might ask why a healthy 75-year-old gets it, but a 36-year-old person who's had a transplant, for example, and who is immunosuppressed has to wait.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. So in doing this process, it's not enough to just look at those kind of, as we say, scientific or medical parameters. So that's why, as part of the vaccine allocation, we had to look at the priority setting process really does have these tangible consequences for people's health, for people's quality of life. And that really requires then that we look at values and principles which underpin those choices. So that's exactly what we did. So we had a number of ethical principles that we actually applied. And one of the most important is fairness. So people want to know that it's fair. So if they want to wait their turn, but they want to recognise that, you know, that there is fairness applied to this process, and that what we have tried and strived to do in terms of this allocation is to ensure that on the one hand, we get the maximum benefit from a very scarce resource. So we want to do the most amount of good, but we also need to balance that with equitable treatment of people. So in the first instance, that has been why it's gone to people who are at most risk of dying or, as I said, developing severe disease. And that we know is from international data and Irish data is those who are older. And many of those people who are older will also have comorbidities, so they will have underlying conditions.
It goes down through the age ranges. And I'm just wondering, too, was any consideration given? Because other countries like France, for example, decided to do it the opposite way. They looked at the situation and decided, we're going to vaccinate younger people. We're going to vaccinate teachers in order to get the workforce back up and running. And they did it the reverse way. Was any consideration given to that here?
Yeah, I think that, most countries, in fact, have very similar priority groups. You'll see that most countries have prioritised older persons and frontline healthcare workers, which is what we have done and what's currently being rolled out. I think that the reason, France has obviously decided to prioritise younger people, but I think that most countries haven't done that, mainly because at the moment, Audrey, we have no idea or very little data available on the effect of these vaccines on transmissibility. So what we do know from the clinical trials is that if you get this vaccine and you later contract the virus, you are much less likely to be very unwell. But what we don't know is whether it will actually stop onward transmission. So if, for example, we had fantastic data that showed that it would stop onward transmission, then that would make sense, for example, maybe to vaccinate younger people who might be out and about more and maybe transmitting the virus more. But we don't have that data at the moment. But I suppose that makes a very important point, which is that this is constantly under review. This is a new virus. We're learning more and more every day. I mean, it may feel like a decade, but in fact, it's only been around for a year. So I think it's really important that all of these things are being kept under review.
Okay.
So, you know, for example, we're learning more about underlying conditions that predispose people to becoming very ill. And so all of that is kept under review by our NIAC. And we will take all of that and ensure that the list is kept as up to date as possible.
OK, I think we've just touched the surface here, but great to talk to you. Thank you very much, Dr. Siobhan O'Sullivan, Chief Bioethics Officer with the Department of Health. It's just gone 7:45.
Dogs, much like ourselves, are sociable creatures who enjoy and benefit from the company of their fellow canines. So no surprise that the increase in dog ownership at a time when opportunities to socialise are at a minimum is leading to an increase in demand for dog training classes. And Dogs Trust Ireland has risen to the challenge with its online classes. Now we're going to talk to Fiona Nolan, their head dog school coach, in a moment. Let's hear first, though, from Kate Horgan. She fostered her dog Red in October last year, and she's one of the many people who are taking online dog training classes.
I signed up for dog school with Dogs Trust just because with Red, I got him when he was 6 months old, so he missed the very young puppy stage, but he was still doing a lot of like puppy things, like jumping up and chewing on you and stuff like that. So I just wanted to get a bit of help with it.
How did you find the online classes?
My dogs would be beside me, but I wouldn't do any of the training with them. I'd just take notes and then spend the week trying to do the training with them. And if I had any issues, I'd just ask the coaches next week. I found I'd always have like kind of weird questions that'd be hard to Google. So like with Red, he was a mad barker when I first got him. So he'd just bark throughout the night. And I didn't want to end up accidentally rewarding that behavior by going down to them. So the coaches were really nice just to be able to ask, what should I actually do?
Now that was Kate Horgan talking about her dog Red, Fiona Nolan from Dogs Trust Ireland. Good morning to you.
Morning, thanks for having me on.
Kate, setting out probably some of the difficulties that a lot of dog owners and new dog owners encounter, what are the most common difficulties that you're coming across at the moment?
Well, we do really cater for all kinds of behaviours, but I suppose the big one that we find is chewing and mouthing. So when I say chewing, that's obviously your furniture, but mouthing, a lot of people would call it maybe puppy biting. So it's not biting, but it's just their way of exploring the world. But it does hurt, so we get quite a lot of that. We also get a lot of people concerned about going back to work. So preventing things like separation anxiety. They would be our two main ones. And then the last, I suppose, of many would be loose lead walking. So getting your dog to walk nicely on the lead as opposed to being pulled down the road, especially in this kind of weather. Definitely not pleasant at all.
Fiona, are the dogs of Ireland worn out from being walked with lockdown?
I wouldn't say so. We have a lot of very young dogs, so obviously they wouldn't be at the fully vaccinated stage, so they can't go out walking. Just because you can walk a dog doesn't mean that we should be doing 5K a day with every dog, and that's very breed dependent. You do see a lot of more dogs out and about, but I don't think that, in my experience so far being online, that I'm seeing a dog who's being overwalked per se.
Okay. It seems to me, though, from what you're saying, that these online classes, your work really is about training the owners to manage their dogs and maybe to understand as well the behaviour of animals.
Exactly. And I think it's a really valuable tool as a dog owner. There are like really, really simple, small things that maybe we find that people had no clue about. For instance, body language is one thing we cover. So that's how our dogs talk to us. So by training an owner to understand what the dog is saying, essentially, is a massive skill to have. So if you can understand what your dog's needs are, you're going to have a really good, strong bond for life and be able to continue on in a positive way.
Are there certain behaviours, Fiona, that dogs will present with that we should be able to read very quickly, like I'm hungry, you know, or if they're barking incessantly?
Well, barking is very, very different, and I suppose what I would say is dog training and dog behaviour, they're slightly different. So a dog trainer, I would always compare, for lack of a better term, I suppose we're more like a GP, whereas a behaviouralist would deal with an established behaviour like a barker, because there's a lot of motivation and a lot of different reasons why they bark, and they're more like your surgeons or consultants. So with things like your dog is hungry, yeah, some dogs will indicate, some dogs won't. They're all individuals. Some dogs will hit the door to say, I need to go to the toilet. Some dogs won't. But there are ways we can teach our dogs and teach our owners to give us certain signals in order for them to maybe get what they want.
Huge increase in dog ownership as well. And you're launching do you describe this as a campaign or an encouragement? You're 99K for canines.
The 99K for canines, it's a fabulous one, and you can get really, really creative. It's all our information you can find on dogstrust.ie, so really, really good, and you can do it indoors. It doesn't mean that you have to take your dog with you if you want to do the 10K or whatever. You can get a treadmill, you know, put in your best effort. You can walk up and down your hall to practice your loose lead walking. You can practice your recall,
all sorts of possibilities.
Run up and down the stairs, things like that, so it's not just walking around, but yeah.
Okay, they can check it out on dogstrust.ie, where they can also check out the online classes. Fiona Nolan, thank you very much.
January has been a tough month and many people are feeling anxious and overwhelmed, balancing remote working and homeschooling or closing a business during level 5 restrictions. And even listening to the news and the latest COVID updates can be very stressful. The pandemic has cast a spotlight on the need to address mental health in the workplace. Stephanie Regan is a clinical psychotherapist who works with employers in providing employee assistance programs. She joins us this morning. Stephanie, what issues in terms of mental health are coming up for employees and employers during this lockdown?
Good morning, Petula. Well, straight up and definitely, the whole issues around the pandemic and all of the personal issues that are in place all of the time, these are the, if you like, the underlay of the problems at the moment. And so everyone is a little different, and yet we all have some similarities. One of the big similarities for people is anxiety, the feeling of not getting forward, the feeling of putting in a lot of effort, but perhaps not making progress. That's something that's very debilitating for people. And I think the third lockdown, people are feeling really depleted. They feel their creativity is gone, and they're really looking for that ray of hope. And I think that's echoed across all levels of our society at the moment, and no more so than when an employee is working perhaps on their own at home, or when an employee is at home and they are trying to juggle childcare and schooling and all of these things. So big issues are keeping up morale, managing isolation, you know, and that is both, so there's two sides to it. There is the employee themselves and what they can do. And then this is also a stress for employers who are trying to do the right thing and trying to support staff at home. And this is what we see as the key things are keeping up morale, isolation, communicating, you know, really trying to keep up that motivation to stay in communication with the organization and with colleagues. And there's so much that can be done, but we've all been kind of fast-forwarded into this without protocols and without systems in place. And I think that's been a challenge for everyone.
Should employers have realistic expectations about what can be achieved and what can be delivered in these times?
Well, to be fair, I think that employers have gone a very long way in trying to address that. You know, they've been surveying their staff really from any organization that I'm dealing with, you know, and quite like medium to small are the ones I would be dealing with. And the larger ones are even more active on this. They have been surveying staff, seeing what they wanted, what they needed from the outset. And they are being very flexible with their staff in terms of childcare, making sure they have the right situation at home and giving them the opportunity to kind of be very flexible around that. One of the things, though, in terms of managing the mental health side, what employers really can do is not just flexibility, but I think they have to model the behaviours. It's not enough to say, oh, you can clock off early, don't you worry, you've got problems. They have to show that they themselves are managing in the same way, you know, that it's that they also are people with children, with stresses, with lives that are complex and difficult, and parents they're concerned about at the moment. And so you don't have to be, if you like, in that high office superior kind of way with your staff. You have to really mirror the behavior that you want them to step back digitally at the end of the day, that you want them to take breaks. And you don't want them to be trying to operate the way they were operating when they weren't remote working. That's a big step, I think, for employers.
They can lead by example there. Briefly, Stephanie, if you could, what's your top tip for employees to survive all of this?
What would be my top tip? Okay, I would say we often talk about, well, leaning into your self-care. You have, you know, as much as organizations and your employer has something to do for you, you really have to do this for yourself. Nobody can mind you better than yourself. Make sure you have a psychological bridge between work and home. In other words, get up and do something for half an hour or an hour before you start your work. Don't step out of bed in your jammies and sit to the computer. That is bad psychologically. And don't stay on Zoom all of the time. You know, these Zoom meetings should be shorter. And close the virtual door. At the end of the day, don't stay there.
Stephanie Regan, clinical psychotherapist, thank you for those insights this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30, but for now, back to you, Audrey.
Well, it's a damp or wet start to the day now, but with overnight rain becoming confined to northern areas through the morning, still some wintry rain possible for a time here. Now, whilst drier weather will develop, it will remain quite cloudy today with patches of mist and drizzle. Cool in over Ulster with afternoon highs of 5 to 7 degrees, but somewhat milder elsewhere with afternoon highs of 8 to 11 degrees. And somewhat breezy today, a moderate, occasionally fresh southerly winds, veering westerly through the day and gradually moderating. Now, tonight will be calm and misty with patchy outbreaks of drizzle, amounts generally quite small, with lowest temperatures of 5 to 9 degrees. And tomorrow, Wednesday, will be another cloudy day. Little showery rain in places to begin. Later in the afternoon, though, a band of heavy rain will begin to feed up from the southwest. Highest temperatures tomorrow generally ranging 7 to 10 degrees. Still quite cool in over the north, with afternoon highs of 4 to 6 degrees in light to moderate southeast breezes. And it's looking very wet in turn tomorrow evening and tomorrow night. Now, on Thursday morning, wintry rain will affect Ulster until mid-morning, with just well-scattered falls elsewhere. However, another band of persistent rain will move up from the southwest later in the day. Highest temperatures on Thursday will range 9 to 11 degrees, but once again looking cooler in over Ulster, with afternoon highs of only 3 to 7 degrees. And then for Friday, well, it's looking like a cold day countrywide with fresh easterly winds, generally dull once again with perhaps a little showery rain and probably a heavier spell of rain moving into Kerry and West Cork, with highest temperatures generally ranging just 3 to 6 degrees on Friday. Today then, in brief, well, it's a damp or wet start to the day, but with overnight rain becoming confined to northern areas through the morning. And whilst drier weather will develop, it will remain quite dull. Highest temperatures today then of 5 to 11 degrees that range north to south, and breezy at times in moderate, occasionally fresh west to southwest breezes. That's the forecast. A very good morning.
Good morning to you. You're welcome if you're just joining us. It's Tuesday, January the 26th, and this is Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson and Audrey Carvel. The 8 o'clock news is read now by Brian Jennings.
The Cabinet will consider today whether to extend the current Level 5 COVID-19 restrictions until early March, as well as introducing a limited form of mandatory quarantine for certain visitors. The proposals were agreed by the Cabinet Subcommittee on COVID-19 last night. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
Extending the current COVID-19 restrictions has been well flagged by ministers over the past week. The date of March 5th would bring Ireland in step with similar restrictions in Northern Ireland. On introducing mandatory quarantine for 14 days, that would only apply to any incoming passenger who arrived without a negative PCR test result or if they had travelled from either South Africa or Brazil. It's also understood that the Cabinet will consider making it mandatory to quarantine at home for people returning from other countries. At the moment, it's just advisory. Sinn Féin, the Labour Party and the Social Democrats have all claimed that the measures don't go far enough, and only a 14-day mandatory quarantine regime for all incoming passengers will be effective. However, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar told RTÉ's Clare Byrne Live last night that such a measure wouldn't be fully effective unless the UK was involved, would last a year, and would drastically reduce the number of people entering Ireland, thereby causing problems for supply chains.
There's been a further reduction in the number of patients in hospital with COVID-19, according to figures from the HSE. University Hospital Waterford is dealing with 125 patients with the virus, the largest number in any hospital. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
There were 1,803 patients with COVID-19 in hospitals around the country last night, figures from the HSE show. That's a reduction of 145 compared with the situation yesterday morning. The number of these patients in ICU has also reduced by 2 to 217. Across the hospital system, there are 30 adult ICU beds free. The hospitals with the most cases are University Hospital Waterford with 125 patients, Cork University Hospital with 124, and St Vincent's with 119. Last night, the National Public Health Emergency Team said the number of cases in hospital had plateaued, but that it would take many weeks for these numbers to reduce.
The findings of a report by an independent research group into the running of mother and baby homes in Northern Ireland will be presented to the Stormont Executive today. Many survivors of the homes are demanding a public inquiry. Our Northern correspondent, Vincent Kearney.
More than 10,000 women are estimated to have passed through the doors of 10 mother and baby homes and 4 Magdalen laundries examined by a team of researchers. Hundreds of babies are believed to be moved across the border from Northern Ireland to adoptive parents in the Republic of Ireland. An interdepartmental group at Stormont will today make a number of recommendations based on evidence from the researchers. Those recommendations will include a possible public inquiry. Northern Ireland's First Minister Arlene Foster and Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill are expected to set out their response in a statement this afternoon. They held a virtual meeting with the Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman, last week to discuss the Commission of Investigation report into mother and baby homes in the Republic of Ireland. They also discussed a joint initiative to examine the issue of cross-border adoption. Vincent Kearney, RT News, Belfast.
Measures introduced due to COVID-19 led to an improvement in Irish prison standards in 2020, according to the Irish Penal Reform Trust. In its latest review, the Trust found that prisoner numbers and cell sharing fell last year under changes made because of the pandemic. Our social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally.
Like other congregated settings, Irish prisons have faced huge challenges due to COVID-19. During the first wave last year, a reduction in prisoner numbers and cell sharing kept the virus at bay. Family visits were substituted with video calls and there was a provision for phones in cells. These approaches have been welcomed by the Irish Penal Reform Trust. However, it says as the country's oversubscribed court system prepares to clear a backlog, any improvements are at risk of being reversed. In its fourth annual review of Irish prison standards, the IPRT also found that more than half of the female prison population in the Docas Centre were cocooning in the early stages of the pandemic because of underlying health conditions. It says Ireland must learn from progressive penal policies like in Scotland, where a gender-specific women's supported bail service helps keep them out of prison by addressing issues that contribute to addiction, mental health, housing and homelessness.
The supermarket chain Lidl is to create 1,200 new jobs in Ireland over the next year. The company intends to open four new outlets here and rebuild a number of its existing stores. It will also expand its regional distribution centre in Mullingar. Separately, 140 new roles are to be created in Dublin by the German HR technology company Personio. A study by the Society of Chartered Surveyors indicates that a couple earning average wages still cannot afford even the cheapest new apartments in Dublin. It also found that three quarters of the apartments surveyed were built to rent, as that was more economically viable for developers. Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Super Value. Get thousands of really low prices in the Super Value range, available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
After a damp or wet start, overnight rain will become confined to northern areas through the morning. Drier weather will develop, but it will remain quite dull. Breezy with highest temperatures 5 to 11 degrees, coldest in the north.
Aisling, thank you. 9 minutes past eight, and here with what it says in this morning's newspapers now is Gail Conway.
An extension of the current lockdown and increased travel restrictions, which the Cabinet is expected to approve today, is the story which dominates today's front pages. The Irish Independent, Irish Examiner and Irish Daily Mirror all lead with plans agreed by the Cabinet Committee on COVID-19 yesterday to extend the current Level 5 lockdown until the first week in March. Decisions made at that same meeting related to travel restrictions generate the lead stories in the Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail. Both papers report that Cabinet's expected to approve measures including mandatory quarantine in designated hotels for incoming travellers without a negative test, increased fines for non-compliance with rules, and a ban on travel from South Africa and Brazil. Under the headline Cracking Down on Travel, finally, the Mail reports that the government made the decision to step up measures, as it's feared that there is a potential that new variants of the virus may render vaccines less effective. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Sun reports that those aged over 85 are the next group to be vaccinated. Back on the front of the Examiner, it's reported there that the mobile phone operator Three is providing the Department of Health and the CSO with data on its 2.4 million Irish customers to monitor compliance levels. The Irish News leads with the line that Northern Ireland Health Minister Robin Swan is also pushing for enforced quarantine for people travelling to Northern Ireland from abroad. The Irish Daily Star leads with a 3-year jail sentence given to a man with 45 previous convictions, including 6 for knife-related offences in Dublin Circuit Criminal Court yesterday. Mark Pidgeon from Coolock in Dublin received the sentence for repeatedly stabbing a man in the Basin Street flats in Dublin 8 last March. For its lead story, the Belfast Telegraph reports that the PSNI has launched an investigation after a large crowd appeared to break coronavirus regulations while attending the funeral in Derry yesterday of 62-year-old former Republican prisoner Eamon Peggy McCourt. The Times and Examiner both give front-page coverage to a new report about drug-related intimidation in Dublin's north-east inner city. The report, called Deaths, Threats, Distress and Hope, concludes that there is a sense of a once strong and close-knit community breaking down. Another report on the cost of building an apartment in Dublin, compiled by the Society of Chartered Surveyors of Ireland, also receives coverage on the front of today's Independent and Times. The Times focuses on how the cost of building a two-bedroom apartment in Dublin ranges from €359,000 in the suburbs to as much as €619,000 in the city centre. Elsewhere this morning, there's a story in today's Times about the arrest of a man in Cork who Gardaí are questioning about allegations that he fished envelopes of cash out of church collection boxes around the country using a wire. And the Times also reports on the public consultation process on a Greenway cycle route from Athlone to Galway is now open. The picture on the front of today's Independent is of Ireland's latest Michelin star winner, Amit Dede, who, we're told, adds his Turkish flair to the best local produce which he sources for his restaurant in Baltimore in West Cork. In a flap, Robin Rage tweets at rival. That's the caption over the picture on the front of today's Times, taken by Kieran Cunningham, of a very aggressive-looking robin fighting off the competition at a bird feeder in Letterkenny, County Donegal. And finally, the Examiner runs with a picture on its front page this morning of writer Alice Taylor, showing off her very impressive window boxes from the far side of the window of her home in Inishannon, County Cork.
The Cabinet will meet today to decide what new measures to put in place to further reduce the numbers of COVID-19 in the community. Its subcommittee agreed last night that level 5 restrictions were in those at the moment. They will stay in place until March the 5th. That people who travel from South Africa and Brazil would be placed in mandatory quarantine for 14 days, as would all people who arrived without a negative PCR test. The Taoiseach said they hope to begin a phased return of schools from next month, beginning with classes for children with additional needs. Meanwhile, in Brussels, pressure and tensions are building over AstraZeneca's production and supply of its vaccine. We can talk now to our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, and our Europe editor, Tony Connolly. So, Paul, another 6 weeks of restrictions, at least changing those, presumably will depend on the case numbers and the hospitalizations at that time.
Absolutely. Restrictions are going to stay. And I know that many hearts will sink across the country at the very thought of that. They are so intrusive. They are so difficult, intruding into people's lives, even demanding that only a certain number of people can attend funerals and all the rest of it. But what the Cabinet is saying, and this subcommittee concluded, was that we have to drive down the virus and therefore additional measures are required. So basically it comes in two form: a limited form of mandatory quarantine, which means basically you will arrive at the airport, be taken to a hotel, which would be surrounded by not Gardaí but by security guards, and you'd have to stay there for 14 days. That mandatory quarantine would apply to people from South Africa or Brazil. That's on the basis of these new COVID-19 variants. And then the second thing is anyone who doesn't bring with them a negative PCR test for COVID-19, they also face a €2,500 fine and 6 months in jail. More enforcement by Gardaí at ports and airports. Once again, it's going to be intrusive, stopping people saying, why are you leaving the state? Is it absolutely essential? Stopping people returning into the state. Once again, why did you leave? And if it isn't deemed to be essential, then you're going to have fines. Indeed, those fines are going to increase. And they're also going to get tougher on people when it comes to travellers entering the state and making sure that they quarantine at home. That's now a mandatory requirement as opposed to advisory, which means action can be taken if you don't do it. So all in all, you've got a tightening of restrictions as well as extending them into March 5th. And the key point out of the March 5th date is to try and keep the Republic of Ireland in step with Northern Ireland.
And Paul, that mandatory quarantine for anyone arriving without a negative PCR test, that means they either have a positive one or they've no test at all. So in that case, why are they being allowed to fly at all? Why not stop them at the departure gate?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that these measures have been signed off by the Cabinet Subcommittee, but they're going to be, a memo will be drafted overnight and presented to Cabinet. Once again, things could change there. There could be further alterations. And even after that, either legislation is going to have to be drafted or a measure will have to be signed off by a minister. So there's issues of detail that we've yet to hear. But on the question of a PCR test, it is the case that in some airports, we heard it on the programme just a number of days ago, where Ryanair was stopping people getting onto plane because the PCR test they had wasn't deemed to be an appropriate one. So some of those measures are already in place. I think what they're trying to do is to make it comprehensive and make it sensible to everyone.
And that 14-day quarantine for people coming from Brazil and South Africa. Now, there's no direct flights to here from those countries. So people, if they are travelling, maybe coming, will be coming from third countries. That will be difficult to work out.
It will be difficult, and I think that you're going to find that when people are arriving into the ports and airports, they're going to be asked those questions. Where have you come from? And we do know that there was the presence of the South African variant, and that was on the basis of people coming forward to say that they had been to South Africa. And so I think what you once again are, to a certain extent, reliant upon is the fact that people are going to be honest and tell you. The second thing is the government is trying to drive down the numbers of people entering the state at all. And then the third thing that Leo Varadkar said on the Clara Byrne show last night is that even if you did look at the transmission that we've had over the past 2 weeks, travel was a very small number, accounted for a very small number of people, but they want to reduce that even further.
Yeah, and let's hear Leo Varadkar, because he was, there have been calls over the last number of days for mandatory quarantine for all arrivals coming into the country, regardless of PCR tests. Now, he spoke about that last night and he said it was challenging.
For us to do it on our own as the Republic of Ireland, it would not be fully effective, because of the border. And it's not people flying into Belfast and coming down to Dublin. It's somebody flying into Belfast, going to their home in Newry, infecting two people there, one of whom is a cross-border worker. So it would be a bit like soup in a sieve. It would slow things down, but it wouldn't be fully effective. The other thing, and we need to be frank with people about this, if we did it, it would probably be for a year. I think once you do a very dramatic public health care measure like that, or public health measure like that, it's hard to reverse. And I think we probably wouldn't reverse it until everyone was vaccinated. And then we'd be heading into the winter and we wouldn't want to open up flights before Christmas. So, you know, people who maybe would like to take a summer holiday in August, people who maybe would like to see their relatives this Christmas they haven't seen next Christmas, that would probably be off the agenda. And thirdly, and again, speaking to my New Zealand counterpart, there's only so much of you can do. So they have about 32 hotels, 4,500 rooms. You know, it's detention centres, really. It's, you know, they're in hotels, but it's not tourism. It's quite a big operation. Security guards, testing, secure transport. You can only let about 500 or 600 people in a day. So that means even some travel that we now consider essential would not be permitted.
That's the Taoiseach, the Leo Varadkar there. Let me bring in Tony Connolly, our Europe editor now. Tony, on these, on the production and the supply of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which Ireland has ordered over 3 million doses of, it's yet to be approved. Things got very heated last night, I thought, between the European Commission and the company. What's been said?
They did get heated, Audrey, and I think it's a reflection of how desperate people are to see the vaccine as the exit path for the crisis. And suddenly at the last minute on Friday to be told or to learn that AstraZeneca is not going to be able to deliver the volumes that, according to the European Commission, had been promised in the contract. Back in August, the Commission signed a contract for up to 400 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Member states placed their own orders through that contract in the autumn. But then the Commission learned on Friday that there would be a shortfall in the delivery. Now, we haven't had any official confirmation of what that shortfall is, but credible reports say instead of getting 80 million doses for the first quarter, there would only be 30 million doses. That's a 60% fall, and that can really disrupt the distribution of the vaccines. And the fact that people need to take two doses, if there's a big shortfall, is that going to seriously disrupt that rhythm and that flow? And that's why yesterday the European Commission issued a very angry statement saying that they were not satisfied with the answers that the company had given, and all but accusing the company of penalising the Europeans in some sense for not delivering what they had promised to deliver, but seemingly there not being a problem with other customers of AstraZeneca. And again, they didn't spell it out, but everyone's thinking about the UK. There's 12 other countries around the world which have approved the vaccine and have been receiving doses of it.
Yeah. And any response from Brussels to this briefing that some German media, some journalists got from their own government's health departments that the AstraZeneca vaccine is not going to be used in Germany in the over 65s because it's not effective?
No official comment last night, and those reports from Bild and Handelsblatt yesterday, two different reports taking somewhat different angles on this issue, widely circulating on social media last night. But AstraZeneca issued a statement strongly denying any of this at all. But we've had no official response from the European side so far. Although, having said that, Eimear Cook, the Irishwoman who's the heads up the European Medicines Agency, which is supposed to authorise the AstraZeneca vaccine on Friday, she'll be appearing before the European Parliament Health Committee later this afternoon. So everyone will be listening to see what she has to say about the general situation and about some of those claims.
Paul, just back to you finally. Is the Cabinet here becoming increasingly worried over the vaccine supplies and the schedule?
Well, they've always said that vaccine supply would determine rollout, and that to a certain extent was out of their hands, given that they were part of an EU collective approach to this. But Professor Breon McCrae, who heads up the vaccine rollout, told RTÉ News last night that the good news was that the rollout would not be delayed despite this problem, which has just incurred. What he couldn't say was whether or not the target date for the completion of the, for health workers, for over 85s, if that would be completed in time because of the question supply. But he said things would still start as they were supposed to start, Audrey. If I can just come back to one thing on the question of mandatory quarantine, just from an, I have to put into us what the opposition parties were saying in relation to what the government's explanation as to why it doesn't, while it's considering mandatory quarantine, isn't going that route so far. Social Democrats co-leader Oisín Shortall says we have to go that way. These are more half-baked proposals from the government and they will not work. The Labour leader Alan Kelly, he was saying that Bertie Ahern, when he was Taoiseach, put 1,000 members of the forces on the border, and he said, why is it that animal disease is more important than COVID-19? The same thing coming from People Before Profit, saying a zero COVID policy is the only way forward, and that is definitely going to be where the political focus is going to be once Cabinet makes its decision.
Okay, we asked for an interview with the Health Minister this morning, but he wasn't available. Thank you both very much for joining us, Paul Cunningham, our political correspondent, and Tony Connolly, our Europe editor.
And as we've been hearing, adherence to level 5 restrictions is reducing the reproduction rate of COVID-19. Neffert saying the number of people with the virus in hospital has peaked and plateaued. But our hospitals are still under strain and will be for some weeks to come. The number of patients in ICU expected to remain very high, the latest figures showing 217 patients in intensive care, hundreds of others receiving critical care outside of these units. Anne O'Connor is the HSE's Chief Operations Officer. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Mary.
And that is good news that the numbers have peaked and plateaued, but how much pressure and how much strain is still on staff in these units and in your hospitals?
Yeah, so Mary, we still have very high numbers, though the number has reduced a bit down to 1,803 last night. We know that that is still a very high number. It's more than double the number we had in the first wave of the pandemic. And as you said, we have, you know, still a very high number of people in ICU. Clearly, that puts a huge demand on our hospital system. We have still got a high level of absenteeism among all of our staff, and we are having to redeploy staff from across the hospitals into ICU. So at the minute we have anything between 300 and 350 nurses redeployed into ICU to be able to cope with that very high number of 217. And as you correctly said, a high number of people then outside of ICU receiving intensive supports too.
And Fergal Bauer is giving us numbers earlier for hospitals like Waterford and Cork and St Vincent's. Are they the ones really, if you like, in the eye of the storm at the moment?
They are experiencing a very, very high demand. However, important to say that we have many hospitals who are really experiencing what they would see now as a crisis situation. I've previously said that the reality is that some of our smaller hospitals, even though the case numbers might be lower, have, you know, they really are in trouble when they get any kind of high numbers of COVID cases. So this is having an impact across our whole system, in the hospitals and outside the hospital in our community services too. And I think it's important that we think about the whole pathway here, because it does impact on everybody in the health system.
And does that mean that in some cases, and you mentioned the smaller hospitals, that you have to take patients, you have to make decisions around patients and where they will receive treatment, that if they present in one, they have to be taken by ambulance someplace else?
Absolutely. So our intensivists think about this all the time. Our intensive care service works really at a national level. And we have transferred many people between hospitals at this stage. We have a mobile intensive care transfer service run by our National Ambulance Service. And they move people around depending on bed capacity. So there's only so much pressure we can put on any one hospital. And we have moved many people between different hospitals, both within their own hospital group and outside of their group.
And how are you helping all of these frontline workers, whether it's within the paramedics or the ICU intensivists, as you say? How is the HSE able to help them, perhaps to cope with the levels of stress and strain that they're operating under?
There's a number of things, Mary, that I suppose from the beginning of the pandemic that we've put in place in terms of, you know, I suppose enhanced occupational health support would be one thing. Trying to be flexible with staff in terms of trying to balance home and work, which is very difficult for many of our frontline workers at the minute. And equally, we've also developed a psychosocial framework with a lot of, inputs from specialists in mental health to support staff to be able to access psychological supports online, in person, because this pandemic is very grueling on people psychologically as well as physically. And for us, we have to ensure that our staff can work.
And it's been ongoing, and this is the third wave. For example, are all ICU staff now in your intensive care units are all around the country? Have they all received at least a first dose of vaccine?
Yeah, so when we started vaccinating our frontline healthcare workers, the priority was to vaccinate within the hospital setting, to vaccinate people who were involved in our COVID pathways. So in terms of our emergency departments, our COVID wards, our critical care units and ICUs. So that has been our priority. I'm sure whether there are some people out there who haven't been vaccinated, I can say, but that has been our priority in terms of rolling out this vaccine across our acute hospitals. The priority for vaccination has been based on people's exposure. Regardless, it's not to do with their grade or their discipline. It's to do with where they are perceived as having most risk. And certainly the guidance that has been developed for our system is based on levels of exposure.
The question of PPE, some question around masks and higher grade masks. Is there an issue?
No, I mean, I think that there is a lot of discussion at the minute around these higher grade masks, the FFP2 masks that you reference. We have been supplying these since the beginning of the pandemic, but we know that there's a very high level of concern among staff across the whole system, not just in hospitals, in terms of their potential exposure. And we have been reviewing guidance very recently, particularly in light of the new variants that have come in. And the guidance that we had is broadly appropriate, but we have acknowledged to hospitals and all services that where they feel they need to supply more of these masks, they can. I think it's important, just Mary, just if I could just note that, you know, pre-Christmas we were providing about 106,000 of these masks a week. Since the beginning of January, we're supplying over 1 million a week. So we are supplying a lot more of these higher grade masks across the whole system.
Anne O'Connor, the HSE's Chief Operations Officer, thank you very much.
Petula is back with the business news.
Thanks, Audrey. The supermarket chain Lidl is to create 1,200 new jobs in Ireland over the next year. The company intends to open 4 new outlets and rebuild a number of its existing stores. Convenience food group Greencore reported revenue of £312 million in its first quarter, a decrease of 15% on the previous year. This reflects the impact of COVID-19 restrictions on demand in food-to-go categories. In a trading update this morning, Greencore said the operational impact of Brexit has been modest to date, as the group has completed extensive Brexit planning. Janet Yellen has been confirmed as the first ever female US Treasury Secretary. She'll be responsible for guiding the Biden administration's economic response to the pandemic. Budweiser has said it will not advertise its beer during the Super Bowl this year. Instead, it plans to support an ad campaign promoting vaccination. On the currencies, €1 buys 89 pence sterling and $1.21.3.
Good morning once again now to Darren Frell.
Hello again, Mary. The Irish men's cricket team looking to finish the Afghanistan series on a high this morning. They lost the first two matches of this, so they've lost the series. But qualification for the 2023 World Cup is now on a league format, so valuable points on offer. And they've started really, really well. Ireland won the toss, they elected to bowl, and currently Afghanistan 100 for 4 after 22 overs. So let's hope they can finish off that match in Abu Dhabi in style and get a much needed win, morale boosting win. Now in Gaelic Games, Connacht CEO John Prenti has some thoughts on controlling the costs of inter-county teams, and this comes in his annual report for the upcoming convention in the province. Now he feels the pandemic has helped the GAA stumble across a new formula to ease financial pressures. He wants training sessions to be capped at 3 per week, 2 on match weeks, match day squads of 26, panel expenses though for only 32 players, and backroom team to be capped at 12. He suggests that the GPA could help police the measures. I'm joined by RTÉ analyst Tomás O'Shea. Tomás, good morning to you, and a bit of deja vu here for you, because this is something you suggested before Christmas, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's if anything, the pandemic, darn it, has thrown up the fact that do we need to train 12 months of the year? Do the inter-county lads need to be training as often as they do? I think what happened before Christmas and the way that the club was divided and the county was divided, it's just given us a pathway. But certainly, if teams stuck to 3 days a week, I think there was no issue last year with the fitness of inter-county teams. The pandemic has proven it can be done. But then, as before, Darren, the danger is to police it. I think going with bigger, more professional backroom teams, some teams are able to do it. It becomes a financial issue. There's a lot of pressure on inter-county teams at the moment. They're saying they're wondering, outside of the health factor at the moment, can they actually afford to go with the national leagues this year? So it is a huge problem. And I think the real difficulty for most counties is they can't afford the way this kind of runaway train has. The balance of the whole thing, Darren, is kind of lopsided in that there's too much given. The time inter-county players are giving at the moment, I think, if anything else, in the last 6 or 7 months, it has shown that the balance is completely wrong and completely weighted wrong. And it has proved to us also, we got some great games last year, that you can actually have a level of fitness and whatever is required and train only 3 times a week, and that can be done.
Yeah, as you say, easier said than done, Tomás. How are you feeling about 2021? We're expecting news from Croke Park by the end of the week in terms of how the season is going to shape up. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, look, Darren, I think this lockdown is tough on everybody. I think everybody's struggling, everybody's suffering. So it would be great to see national leagues. It would be great to see action. But I think it's a tricky one. I think it's different to pre-Christmas. I think pre-Christmas, the numbers were way down. And even when they were down, people were wondering, why do the GAA, who have players immersed in the community, get to actually put their players out and play games and all that? And I think in the current situation, with the way numbers are, I think it would be reckless and irresponsible to go back into it the way things are right now. Hopefully the plan is, and let's see what the GAA say, but I would say I don't think the GAA would have a right to go back into it right now with the way numbers are. I think they'd have to wait, and hopefully in the next month, if we can get numbers down, we get schools back open and all that, then the GAA can come back into line. But right now, I think if it stayed the way it is, that we'd be in danger of probably losing the league, because there's no way I think you can safely put players out. I think the new strain of the COVID virus and all that, I just think it would be lunacy. And I just hope that the numbers would come down to a level where, yes, it would be safe to do so. And it's very difficult for the GAA then to kind of predict what way the numbers will be in a month's time. So I think whatever plan the GAA will give, I'm not sure to be set in concrete. I think they'll have to just go with the flow like everybody else, and all other elements of society have to do as well.
Tomás, just a final word, quick word if you don't mind as well. Paul Murphy, the new Kerry captain for 2021.
Yeah, Darren, look, it's a strange one in Kerry. There was Kerry have a certain way of doing it with the captaincy. I mean, they have whoever wins the county championship gets to pick the captain. Now, East Kerry are the best team in the county at the moment, and they're winning a couple of championships. Paul Murphy was not part of the East Kerry team last year, but this year he was part of it, and now he's picked. A lot of people saying that David Clifford was too young for it. I have no issue with Paul Murphy being captain. I think he'll be a good captain. He's the most senior player there. People will look at it as the captaincy being taken off David Clifford. I don't think that's the case. A lot of people say he's a bit too young to be carrying it. He's carrying enough pressure at his. But as an overall, Darren, I don't agree with that. I think the manager should be able to pick the proper captain, pick his own captain, instead of being dictated to by the county championship, and that's the way it is in Kerry, I think, Kilkenny. I think most counties do it the other way, and there was a vote in Kerry last year to change that, and they stuck with the old process. So, look, that's the way it is. I think Paul Murphy is a good choice. I think he'll be a good captain.
Okay, good talking to you as always. Just some other news briefly. Tottenham beat championship strugglers Wickham 4-1 to reach the FA Cup fifth round. They'll play Everton next. Thomas Tuchel expected to be named new Chelsea manager before the next game against Wolves tomorrow. Racing at Down Royal has been cancelled because of a frozen track. And just to give you the latest score on the cricket, Afghanistan now 102 for 4 after 24 overs.
Slaney Foods in Buncloddy in County Wexford has confirmed 42 positive COVID-19 cases. 66 other cases confirmed among staff at a separate meat plant in Bandon in County Cork. Our agriculture correspondent Fran McNulty joins us now. Fran, big numbers here in these two plants. What more can you tell us?
Well, Audrey, these two plants between them employ around 900 people, and the numbers that you have outlined there are significant. We know that the cases were detected through a serial testing regime. The authorities have been in meat plants right across the country on an ongoing basis. A rolling series of tests are carried out every couple of weeks in meat plants to see what the number of people that are there are, what the issues are. We know this happens because up to August of last year, there were close to 1,500 cases across meat plants. The industry had a significant issue with COVID in many of its facilities, and so the authorities got involved, new regimes were put in place, and this testing regime, it has to be said, has kept the numbers down, because where people are detected, they're taken out of the system. And we also know that on top of this serial testing, which has been carried out by the state, 100,000 people tested since August. We also know, in addition to that, I am aware that some meat companies are providing rapid testing for their staff themselves. They are so keenly aware of the impact which COVID can have in a meat plant and how quickly it can spread.
And what impact specifically will these cases have on the operations in Buncloddy and Bandon?
The numbers aren't small when you look at the number of people who have tested positive. What ABP, which is the company which owns both of these plants, both Bandon and they also own Slaney Foods in Buncloddy, they're saying that there is a significantly reduced capacity as a result of this. Now, you know, speaking to people in both counties, the kill is as it normally would be in these plants. The same number of animals are being processed. So either staff are being brought in to cement that, or else animals are being brought away elsewhere. Carcasses are being brought away elsewhere to be processed. So the company has put in place a particular arrangement so that they can continue to operate in the same way they would. But there's no doubt about it, this would be a source of disappointment to people in the sector, Audrey, because they have been going to real lengths to try and stop the spread of COVID in plants. But we know that when it gets into meat plants, it tends to spread quickly. It's the nature of the work. It's how close people are to one another. And in these particular cases, if you look at the community transmission rate in Wexford, as an example, it is amongst one of the highest in the country at the moment. And that has possibly been attributed to this outbreak, at least in Buncloddy.
Okay, Fran, thank you very much. Fran McNulty, our agriculture correspondent. Stay with us on Morning Ireland. More to come after this short break.
Now, with Ireland on the cusp of introducing a limited form of mandatory quarantine, we are going to take a look at Australia, which implemented hotel quarantines from the start of the pandemic. And experts attribute much of the country's success in keeping deaths and numbers low to a swift border lockdown and hotel quarantining. The Australian ambassador to Ireland is Gary Gray. Ambassador Gray, good morning and welcome to Drive Time.
Good morning, Mary.
And indeed to Morning Ireland, I should say, remembering my old birth. Ambassador, today, of course, is Australia Day, a day of celebration for some, a controversial date and problematic for others. Will it be marked this year?
It will be, and it is a day of celebration and acknowledgement of pain. So We're used in Australia to dealing with our Australia Day, acknowledging the pain of settlement in Australia, but also acknowledging the great achievement of Australia on the world stage and in our own backyard.
I want to move on, Ambassador, because you have experience now since last March of a mandatory quarantine for all international travellers coming into your country. How did you put it in place and how is it working?
So the idea was the idea of the Premier of Victoria. So the idea actually came from government that we should have the kind of lockdown that we put in place. Now, it's not just for international travellers. We have these kinds of isolation measures for people who move across jurisdictions. So travelling from Western Australia into South Australia or from Queensland into New South Wales. So crossing borders is something that we have worked very hard to control, to manage the disease. But we're able to do that because of the nature of our island, the nature of interstate travel, and the ability to lock the place down.
And if somebody is crossing a border or they're landing at your ports or at your airports, what happens when this mandatory quarantine kicks in?
I'll give you a real example. We had an airplane take off from Adelaide late last year. In flight in Adelaide, they identified the UK strain of the virus. Everyone on that plane expected to be able to get off the plane and go about their business in Perth. They were then placed in quarantine. Adelaide was locked down and the borders were closed. Placed in quarantine means placed in a hotel, and it therefore means that you cannot move out of that hotel or out of your hotel room for the period of that quarantine.
And it's 14 days in quarantine and you pay for this pleasure, for this quarantining or detention. How much does it cost?
$3,000 for the first adult, so roughly 2,000 euros. For a family, roughly 5,000 Australian dollars. And after you've paid for the initial adult at 3,000 Australian dollars or 2,000 euros, you'll pay about $1,000 for every kid thereafter, to a limit of 5,000 for a family.
And what are your rules then around PCR tests? If people arrive in your country with a negative PCR test, or do they have to go through PCR tests at different stages during their time in quarantine?
Well, you now cannot board an aeroplane heading for Australia without a negative PCR test.
So there is no question of anybody entering your country without...
No, and Mary, it would only be reasonably... That's correct. And it would only be reasonable of me to say we strongly discourage travel. We strongly discourage travel. I don't know the government that encourages travel, but we strongly discourage travel.
You're here as opposed to there, of course, but what is life like in Australia now?
It's tough if what you want to do is travel. But in reality, we are in a situation where the disease is managed and controlled in most areas. It does break out from time to time. There's no magic wand here and there's no magic solution. And governments have worked really hard to try to get the protocols right. The Irish government have been fantastic at advising our government in Australia how to manage some really difficult parts of COVID. So in aged care homes in particular, and those facilities, we learned a lot from the Irish experience. We have a lot of Irish nurses and doctors working in Australia, helping us manage the disease.
Ambassador, you know, one of the consequences, of course, of this has been a cap on the numbers that are allowed into your country, which has affected tens of thousands of Australian citizens who've been stranded overseas. We're going to hear from one, Harry Barkman. He's one of over 400 Australians who found themselves stranded here in Ireland and unable to return home. He's been speaking to our reporter, Joan O'Sullivan. Have a listen.
There are no flights. One thing is that there are no flights. The other thing is it's extremely expensive if you are lucky enough to find a flight. And then the government repatriation flights, $2,200 Australian dollars, but you can't get on them. You can't get on them either. When you get a message from DFAT, an email from DFAT saying, you know, they're being offered, when you immediately go to the site when you wake up in the morning, there's nothing available. They're all gone.
Why are you so anxious to get home?
We had a family tragedy last year, and my mother's 85, and I really only came back this time to explain the situation face to face with my partner, and then go back and you know, look after my mum.
And was your mum by herself at the moment?
Yeah, she's by herself. She's totally by herself, and so she's feeling very isolated. And you know, she's 85, and I feel like I want to be with her, and I can't get a flight.
And do you have any hope of being able to return to Australia in the next few weeks, in the next few months?
No. I've been abandoned. I've been abandoned by the Australian government. I can't see any hope until everybody's been vaccinated.
Henry Barkman there, Ambassador. He feels abandoned. What are you doing for Australians stranded abroad?
We're working hard to get Australians home who need to travel. It is difficult, beyond any question. It is truly difficult to travel. And we do that because we're trying to keep people safe and keep Australia safe. Well, we've got a list right now of about 450 Australian residents in Ireland who want to get back to Australia. We can't get them all back right away, but we work very hard to move people through the system. Henry's no doubt been in touch with our office. I don't know him, but certainly I'm aware of the case. And I'm aware of how difficult it is to get back to Australia. That's just how it is. It's tough.
Ambassador Gary Gray, thank you very much.
And are you ready to hear some music from a real live concert over the weekend? Well, here it is. That's the Flaming Lips playing in Oklahoma to a big crowd. How did they do it? Space bubbles, plastic bubbles, each band member in one and the fans in their own. The concept came from the band's frontman, Wayne Coyne, who often rolls over the crowd in a Zorb ball. Each bubble has its own speaker, a water bottle, a battery-operated fan, a towel and a I gotta go pee or it's hot in here sign. Well, I've been speaking to Wayne Coyne, who's been telling me if fans enjoyed this unique experience.
You know, I don't know. I guess it's like the hypnotist trick, you know. It's like the people that want to be in it are going to like it. You know, I can't imagine, you know, someone really thinking, this is a horrible idea and I hate it, and then going to all the trouble to come to Oklahoma City and do it, you know. So, you know, we probably are, you know, we're picking a biased audience because they love the Flaming Lips and they love the idea of the space bubble. And so, you know, there's that going for it. But, you know, I think that's kind of a characteristic of the Flaming Lips audience anyway, is that they would be adventurous, and they would be up for doing something different, and they would be up for the idea of taking care of each other and being, you know, into this thing and not being reckless and not being crazy and not being negative, you know. So, I would say just by the fact that it's the Flaming Lips, you know, audience in there, it's going to work better, yeah.
And what's it like for you, Wayne, performing inside one?
Well, you know, like I'm the only person, you know, on the planet Earth that's probably done it, you know, as much as I have. I mean, I wouldn't be in it very long each performance, but since 2004, you know, I would go out sometimes at the beginning of the show and be in it like for 10 minutes, and other times, you know, I'd go out in the middle of the show, still be in it for, you know, 9 or 10 minutes almost every show. So, I mean, you know, I'm pretty used to it, you know, and I'm used to the way that it sounds. And, of course, I'm, you know, when I would be doing it, I would be kind of rolling over the top of the audience. And I got pretty used to doing that, where if you're not used to doing that, you could get thrown around, wouldn't really know how to handle it, you know. So for me, you know, all that kind of second nature, you know, I think anything that you do, when you've got that much adrenaline flowing through you and it makes you happy, I don't know, there's some chemical reaction happens to you and you become really obsessed and good at it or something, you know.
I'm sure you can't wait to get back to normal, to get back to touring and performing just like the old times. Can you see that happening?
Well, I can, but I don't want people to think that. I mean, for me, you know, the idea of us playing, I think it's cool. But part of it is that people want to go to shows anyway, and there are shows that go on that I feel like are kind of not very safe. You know, people are just drawn to screaming in each other's faces. You know, it's just part of the. You know, that's what happens when the music is loud, and especially, you know, at concerts where people are getting sweaty and they're there for, you know, an hour or 2 hours just right there in each other's faces, you know. So I think we only thought, well, I think we could do it safely because there were other concerts going on that we really felt like if people are going to go to them if there's no alternative. And so it was a little bit of, we weren't itching to be, we have to go out there and play, you know. Part of it was that we thought, well, you know, here's an alternative to going to these things where, you know, people's masks won't be on and they'll be all sweaty and drunk. And even as strange as it is to say, you know, here in America, there are the disbelievers who will be there and just say, well, you know, what do you have your stupid mask on for? So when, you know, when concerts do come back, you know, sure, it will be such a great relief. But, you know, everything will come back. So, you know, the traveling around and even just having a party backstage before the concert. I mean, that was part of it as well. You know, we're literally driving to the show and jumping out of the car and running up to the space bubble. So there's a lot of dimensions to music that isn't just playing the music that I think we all kind of forget that's part of the what makes you love it so much is that just
Absolutely.
Getting together and. Yeah, you know,
it's such a communal experience, it really is. And Wayne, you have so many fans here in Ireland, and I'm sure they can't wait to see you back on this side of the Atlantic again.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, we didn't take it for granted. I don't want to say that, but, you know, we would get very used to being able to go anywhere in the world virtually any time that we wanted. And, you know, gosh, we didn't know what a great, special, wonderful privilege it was just to run around like that. I think we'll always have a great, great appreciation for that. But thank you for saying that. Even hearing your accent, I feel like, oh man, you know, it's given me a little bit of a homesickness, you know.
And that's Flaming Lips frontman Wayne Coyne, who's not 100% sure, but he's almost sure there's some Irish in him. Wayne Coyne, thanks to him for talking to us earlier from Oklahoma. It's 9:01.